Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm really happy to have as my guest Marisha Pessl, whose first novel, Special Topics in Calamity Physics, has just been published by Viking. The book has gotten a huge amount of attention. It's, you know, the striking debut first novel of the year. And what intrigues me about it is that it has the courage to be a straightforwardly literary book. It's narrated by a young woman at Harvard named Blue Van Meer. Her mother died when she was five. Her father, we suspect, discover, has abandoned her. And in some sense, she's writing the book. She finds herself in a lecture hall writing the word goodbye up and down the margins. She's writing the book as a kind of bridge to her past, in a sense?
Yes, absolutely. And that's, I think, informed by, because she's lived so much of her life, as she goes on to eventually write down her story, but she's lived so much of her life not with peers, but really traveling with her father and reading voraciously in her Volvo station wagon as they traveled across America. So that has informed her desire to tell the story is something that is part of those old classic books we read, those Victorian novels where someone had an incredible story to tell and a weight on their shoulders that they could only lift by telling this story. Which Wuthering Heights comes to mind in terms of using that as a structure. So she very much is aware of that when she decides to write her story once and for all.
And she decides that in order to organize it, she will take her father's advice and arrange it according to a syllabus, the syllabus of novels, presumably her favorites, although she doesn't talk much about the books she's chosen to organize it around. They're both well-known books, and then books as well that I thought only I read, a book translated as The Awful Mess on...
Right, the Italian.
The Via Marilana. Mm-hmm. And it's, in a way, it's as if she's trying to dream her life into literature in some sense, do you think?
Well, that very much so. I mean, the way she has always interpreted the world, from the harrowing to the heart-wrenching, whatever happens to her in her life, she, because she hasn't lived, she only interprets it through these books that she's read. So by structuring her story in that fashion, they're sort of landmarks for her or lighthouses. That's always how she's found her way. And ultimately, those books help her begin to interpret the world and these mysteries that begin to unravel around her. So that structure felt like a natural extension of her character.
Because of the trip in a car across America with a professor father and a range of literary illusion, people have been thinking about Nabokov when talking about this book. But they don't, outside of those things, seem superficial. The resemblance seems more deeply worked into Blue's sensibility. Nabokov is her father's favorite writer, and it's almost as if she wants to be, as a young woman, a mini Nabokov. She's pulling some of the tricks that Nabokov liked to pull. One of the most famous two words in all of Nabokov comes in parentheses.
Yes.
Picnic, lightning.
Yes. Yeah, she shamelessly cribs some of those things from him, certainly.
And it goes very far. She's joking, but by the end she talks about Trotsky, parentheses, ice pick, head.
Yeah.
It's a kind of running joke.
Mm-hmm.
But it is also, I think, that Nabokov wrote about people who don't quite know the difference between art and life and where their own dreams and confusions end and the lives of real people begin. And I think that that is what Blue was facing in this book, that people talk about it as if it were a whodunit that had a simple answer, but it's a whodunit that has a Nabokov answer. This particular young person will never find her way out of the labyrinth that's been constructed around her. Or am I wrong?
Oh, no, that's absolutely it. And as a, well, as that very much came from, as I worked on her character, and she really had this, all of the books were really her roadmaps for interpreting the world. But as a reader, I mean, as the writer, I was just playing with the potential reader, because as they are reading this novel, I think they're also thinking back to other books that they've read in order to precipitate what's going to happen in the action. So I'm hoping that that certainly keeps the reader off kilter. So that is Blue's experience, but also the what I was hoping that the reader would start experiencing, so you can associate that sense of having everything that's come before you and being utterly confused by what you're perceiving and what you're biased by, exactly like Blue.
And that because so much of one's experience, if one is literary, is conditioned by the books one's read, the mere mention of a certain kind of book leads you to expect,
exactly,
this heroine will kill him herself,
exactly,
or a murder will happen.
Exactly.
And now, but it is in certain ways mysterious, and even more mysterious is that not a single reviewer has said what calamity physics is or even ventured a guess. But what is calamity physics?
Well, calamity physics is what Blue has decided to name her story. And it really specifically focuses on the conceit mentioned in the beginning when Gareth, Blue's father, is waxing poetic on the nature of a professor, how he can put, a professor can put a veritable frame around life, an arbitrary frame of a piece of life, and in so doing, isolate it and allow yourself to exhume it and classify it and eke out truths, when in fact the reality is those truths are quite arbitrary. So by naming her life Calamity Physics, Blue is exactly doing that. She's writing down this story in an attempt to delineate those truths and try to shine light on those nooks and crannies which at the time she wasn't able to see through. I, as an author, I like the word calamity simply because it connotes disaster and has sort of catastrophic connotations, and yet there's the element of humor to it. And I think that's very much part of Blue's voice, even though she really witnesses some horrific things and undergoes quite a bit of stress, she's always able to see the humor, which is personally for me something very human that I always like to hold on to. So
the other thing that seemed to me to be fabulously Nabokovian is your and Blue's gifts with descriptions. Someone is putting cheese that looks like sawdust, or characters sit in a half-melted chocolate couch, or another character is gifted at repair and is capable of handling a dazed and confused garage door. And I wondered about that, because that seems to me to be that place, although it's not story, the constant eye for wit in a character's environment is what carries a story along. Mm-hmm. Anything left unobserved in a novel, since it is made of words, goes unseen. And all of these moments of observation mm-hmm. really bring the furniture, the clothing, mm-hmm. everything around to a kind of startled life.
Mm-hmm. That exactly is something that I was inspired by. In college, I read an essay by Nabokov, or I think perhaps this was one of his interviews when he talked about that he loved the idea of the writer as enchanter, someone who really took the time to create a very detailed world, a world that was separate from our reality, and certainly it has parallels to our real world, and yet it is magical, or it has elements of or it's more satirical than our real life. And I wanted to do that as a writer, because those were the books that spoke to me, when the writer really took the time to see all of those details. I didn't want to be lazy. I really wanted to stop and see the strand of hair in a question mark on Eva Brewster's blouse and the lint balls on Hannah Schneider's skirt. Because if I get to see that, then the reader gets to see that. And in those details, that's where humanity is revealed. So I was very much wanting to do that for the reader. And Jonathan Franzen, I think, was saying in a lecture that for all the good writers that he's read, or all the good books that he's read, he just feels like he needs to return the favor when he's writing. And I very much feel the same way. I really want to do my best. And in this case, it means seeing those details and the humor in those details as well.
Now, here's what I started to look for but didn't see. Because, you know, for me, the name Nabokov conjures certain other requirements. Famously, I guess the first time I read about Nabokov, I think it was in Time magazine when Ada came out, and they pointed out that the letters in the words Van's book rearranged to Nabokov's, and Van
right.
was the narrator of Ada,
mm-hmm.
or Nabokov would create a character named Vivian Darkbloom,
right.
Who was an anagram entirely of Vladimir Nabokov. So, of course, with my reading dazed eyes, I started looking for anagrams of Marisha Pessel and things of that sort, and I don't think that that is, in fact, the way this book is structured, but you can tell me.
No, certainly. I mean, there are no anagrams for Marisha Pessel. At least if there are, I'm not going to tell you. It's up to you to find them. But I am very much in the sense that the way he hid additional clues, because I think I've always been enchanted with the simple idea of a sleuth, and the books that I've responded to are always those where I can read them quickly and be a passive reader. But if I really want to pay attention and start digging for additional layers, they might be there. So there's certainly those sorts of clues littered throughout Special Topics for the truly mad readers.
Well, you see, that's why I was curious, because at the end of the book, there's a final exam. Some of them true and false questions, some of them multiple choice questions, and finally an essay. But I noticed that among the choices are things that Blue has not told us, and presumably are things that she hasn't allowed herself to know. So I began to feel that the author of the final exam was not Blue. How do you go about then knowing when a speculation is accurate or not?
The final exam is actually written from Blue's perspective, but it is a return to the present, I will tell you that. So she is writing that now, not narrating it from the perspective that it was in the past. She's now returned to the present, which is paralleling the introduction when she writes this particular story. So she has that extra element of time passage, and having written out her story, new planes of reality and potential holes that she might have missed during the living of this story have emerged.
Okay, but if someone, since that gap between the end of the story and her arrival at Harvard, where she's writing this novel, is not filled, I began to think that, like the index in Pale Fire,
mm-hmm.
One gradually comes to understand that Kinboat couldn't have constructed that
right.
index, that there's an additional editor.
Exactly.
And so what tells me that Blue constructed this exam? In other words, what limits my interpretive zeal in the right directions?
Well, I think that it's very much her voice, particularly in the essay question, that is Blue's voice. And I think the final chapter, prior to the final exam, the metamorphoses, you have a sense of where mentally she's going with this and how she will be interpreting her life and moving forward. So it is very much her voice, but then there is the added element of time having passed. So I think you'll find the clues. And actually, there are all of the suggestions or all of the options in the multiple choice are backed up by the clues throughout. But those were perhaps the ones that she was not aware of while she was living it. But they are all there. So you don't have to it's not coming completely out of nowhere. Everything is there for a reason.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Marisha Pessel, author most recently of Special Topics in Calamity Physics, published by Viking. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Marisha Pessel about her novel, Special Topics in Calamity Physics. Now, one of the delights is that the world that Blue is encountering at her, private school, is a kid world of cliques and people who are included and left out. And she's narrating this, perhaps for the first time that I've seen it, someone who's brilliant enough not to care, but who was nevertheless caught up gradually. It's almost as if they're trying to recruit her for Chick Lit, and her father sees it and eventually threatens to take her away from the places where all of these social intrigues are taking place. So it's the hilarity of reading a sophisticated literary novel about a subject thought to be un or even anti-literary.
Yes, I mean, I didn't really think of that. I really feel that once I have a particular main character, I can take them to Timbuktu, I can take them to Calcutta, I can take them to Antarctica, or I can move them through different social groups and different societies, and they'll always have something interesting to say once I've done work on character. So I didn't ever feel literally there were things off limit. Oh, Chick Lit, like, can't have any sort of high school crush because it's been done before and everyone would think it's like a John Hughes movie or anything like that. So once you establish those characters, you can really, the exciting thing is you can take them anywhere with you and they'll always have something good to say. So I didn't ever think anything was off limits.
For me, the terror of Nabokov was a genuine terror as a reader that I might not be good enough to read Nabokov's next book, but I knew Nabokov would be good enough to write Nabokov's next book.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, while I might fail him, he would never fail me.
Right.
He would always have something still more amazing and more demanding up his sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that this was the person who really wanted me to see that everything you know about the world, everything you can know about the world, makes the world hold together, that we're looking for the pattern that orders everything. And that's why I compare it to DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So please pardon me for asking you so much about Nabokov.
No.
But it's very interesting to me. This is not an aspiration that many young writers have, and I think you have it, but I think it presents an enormous challenge to you as a writer, to really know the things, you know, because Blue is often playing around. She's citing books that don't really exist. She's making up publishing houses that don't happen. But you know, with Nabokov, every single one of those fit into a pattern of meaning. You know, it's like astonishing to be reading 30 years after Lolita was published, people still making discoveries that the slightest of the details is relevant to the making of the book.
Yeah. Well, that is how that's just how I approach my job in terms of imagining each of those details and creating that world and having it hold together in the sense that, well, as you were saying before, the idea that when someone comes to pick up your book, they'll know that there isn't something that's just there arbitrarily, that things have been thought through quite, and they appear in the novel for a specific reason. So I think that a lot of readers tend to think that books are written very quickly, so for something to be a little bit denser, hopefully is not daunting, but something exciting that you can actually spend your time. And if you do start to look and dig and excavate certain things on the page, that it's not arbitrary and that you will find further clues or insight into the exact events that are happening, in this case, around Blue.
One of the things that fascinated me about the book is that while the characters are, for the most part, privileged characters going to a private school, talking about things that privileged people talk about, the understructure of the book alludes to a world of third world nations, of coups d'etat, of the way in which another world is being ordered and attended to. And in fact, that other world is interested in attacking the culture of greed. And I wondered if you would talk a bit about the politics of this novel.
Well, I know that a lot of people believe that starts to occur, or those things start to bubble up toward the latter part of the novel.
They're throughout.
Yes, exactly. I mean, if you go back, and I'll give you a little hints here. If you go back in the initial chapters where Blue is talking about her father Gareth's childhood as an orphan and his emergence as this larger-than-life political science professor. He was an orphan, and the towns in which he's lived and the countries in which he's performed his field work all around the world all have certain a very specific political agenda or a political atmosphere at the time of the year in which he's traveled there.
May I ask you, it often seems that Blue is, in a sense, being prepared. Has she entered that underworld by the end of the novel?
That's one of the questions I really choose not to answer, but I think that the reader can come to his or her own conclusions, particularly in the way that she has structured her story. It's very much in her father's footsteps, but you don't necessarily think that she is in the same place mentally as he, so it's really up to the reader to answer that.
She seems to be smarter than her father, and it's almost as if, in his own way, her father knows his limitations and wants her to be someone capable of being better than he is.
Absolutely. And I think if you a lot of the things that he says at the beginning of the novel when she's recounting the travels, it sheds light on exactly the nature of what he's preparing her for. And every now and then, I mean, he's a bit of an iceberg. There's the surface and there's a great deal happening under the surface. And occasionally the tide recedes and you can see a little bit more of him, and that's revealed through dialogue.
Because it's my suspicion that a good deal of the novel is that way too, that it is an iceberg that conceals as much, at least, as it reveals. And one of the things that struck me as peculiar is that while the book is being wildly, wildly praised, none of the people praising it seem to want to parse what's under its surface, as if they like the prose so much and they kind of know what kind of novel this is. Nabokov gives them the example. But I'm surprised because, you know, when Pale Fire came out, Mary McCarthy wrote a review. Even Nabokov admired it. He said, some of the mushrooms she finds and puts in her basket are not mine, mm-hmm. but she does a very tidy job.
right.
And I'm just curious, as a writer, how do you feel? Are you rooting for people to start to discover what the book really is? That's what really does interest me, that a book like this is coming out and is, in a sense, yes, people are being recommended toward it, but no one's kind of saying, hey, you know, look at this, look at this, look at this. I don't know how to put these things together, but there's a fascinating web being woven here. And not a word about it in what people are writing.
I absolutely agree with you, but I do, I mean, I have a sense of these, a lot of the reviewers have so many books to get through and perhaps that they don't have, I think just the sheer mechanical nature of reading books and having to write a review with a deadline, you cannot afford to go back and read a book a second time. And they're not reading these books for a college literature class. They're not going to be writing a dissertation on them. So I think just the nature of what they're doing and that there is a time element involved, they can't dig deeper. But I do hope readers, and I have met quite a few at readings recently who've read the book now three times and certainly are taking that time. So I understand the reviewers perhaps can't delve or start their archaeological dig, but maybe my hope is that readers will.
I've been talking with Marisha Pessl, author most recently of her first novel, Special Topics in Calamity Physics, published by Viking. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from Special Topics in Calamity Physics on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica, and you can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, from our website. Go to kcrw.com and look for Bookworm under KCRW A to Z. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.